scarce after Dr. King, along with Negro-owned dress shops, drugstores, and cafeterias. By the time I was born, Sweet Auburn, once the richest Negro street in the world, was split in two by the freeway and left to die. Stubborn Ebenezer was still standing, a proud reminder of her famous son, whose marble tomb in eternity flame kept watch next door. When I was 24, living in New York City, I thought that maybe black love went that way too, integrated into near extinction. Nikki Giovanni said, "Black love is black wealth." On a drunk night in the West Village, my roommate Imani tattooed this on her right hip, hoping for the best. She and I were both HBCU alums, so grad school was culture shock and dystopia at the same time. In art school, there were only two of us who were black, and the other one, a guy, seemed to be mad at me every day for spoiling his uniqueness. Imani was in the same boat, getting her poetry degree, so we took jobs waiting tables at Maroon's, a restaurant in Manhattan that specialized in black comfort food from all over the globe. Jerk chicken, jollof rice, collard greens, and cornbread. Our boyfriends were our supervisors, smoldering men with colonial accents. Too old, too broke, and too handsome, they were as faithless as the weather. But like Imani said, black and alive is always a good start. Back then, I was trying to fit into the New York artsy scene. I was always on a diet, and I tried to stop saying y'all and ma'am. For the most part, I was successful, unless I was drinking. After three gin fizzes, all that Southwest Atlanta came pouring out like I never had an elocution lesson. Roy, back then, lived in Atlanta Metro, but only barely, renting an apartment so far out that he could hardly catch the R&B station on the radio. He worked a cubicle job that compensated him fairly well for agreeing to integrate their workplace. He didn't like or dislike it. For him, a job was a means to an end. The travel part of it he did enjoy, since before signing on, he hadn't ventured west of Dallas or north of Baltimore. Of course, I wasn't aware of any of this when Imani seated his party at a big round table in my section. All I knew was that table six was a party of eight, seven of whom were white. Expecting him to be that kind of brother, I was all business. As I recited the specials, I could feel the black guy staring at me, even though the redhead to his left appeared to be his girlfriend, leaning toward him as she read the menu. Finally, she ordered a sorrel caipirinha. "And what will you have, sir?" I asked him. Chilly as a tax auditor. "I'll have a Jack and Coke," he said. "Georgia girl." I flinched like someone slipped an ice cube down the back of my shirt. My accent? All the people at his table grinned, especially the redhead. "You don't have a southern accent," she declared. "All of us are from Georgia. You're all Yankee." Yankee was a white word, the verbal equivalent of the rebel flag, leftover anger about the Civil War. I turned back to the black guy. We were a team now, and gave the tiniest of eye rolls. In response, he gave an almost imperceptible shoulder shrug that said, "White folk gonna white folk." Then he leaned slightly away from the redhead, this time communicating, "This is a work dinner. She isn't my date." Then in words, he said, "I think I know you. Your hair is different, but didn't you go to Spelman? I'm Roy Hamilton, your Morehouse brother." I never really bought into the Spellhouse mentality about us being brothers and sisters, maybe because I had been a transfer student, missing out on the freshman week rituals and ceremonies. But at that twinkle, it was as though we discovered that we were long-lost play cousins. "Roy Hamilton," I said the name slowly, trying to jog some sort of memory, but he looked too much like a standard-issue Morehouse man, the type who declared his business major in kindergarten. "What was your name again?" he asked, squinting at my name tag, which read Imani. The real Imani was across the room wearing a celestial tag.
Imani, the redhead said, clearly annoyed. Can't you read?
Roy pretended like he didn't hear her. No, he said, that's not it. Your name was something old-timey, like Ruthie May.
Celestial, I said. I'm named for my mother.
I'm surprised you don't go by Celeste now that you're up here in New York City. I'm Roy. Roy Othaniel Hamilton, to be exact. At the sound of that middle name, talk about old-timey, I did remember him. He had been a playboy, a Mac, a hustler, all those things. My manager, who only yesterday insisted that he was not my man, cleared his throat. Game, recognized game, and all of that.
Is this nostalgia? Is this how it really happened? I wish we had taken a photo so I could remember how we looked later that evening standing outside the restaurant. Winter arrived early that year. Roy wore a lightweight wool coat with a puny little scarf that probably came with it. I was bundled against the elements in a down coat Gloria sent me, so convinced was she that I would die of hypothermia before I finished my artist phase and came back home to get a master's in education. Snow fell in wet clumps, but I didn't tie my hood, wanting Roy to see my face. Much of life is timing and circumstance. I see that now. Roy came into my life at the time when I needed a man like him. Would I have galloped into this love affair if I had never left Atlanta? I don't know. But how you feel love and understand love are two different things. Now, so many years down the road, I recognize that I was alone and adrift, and that he was lonely in the way that only a ladies' man can be. He reminded me of Atlanta, and I reminded him of the same. All these were reasons why we were drawn to each other, but standing with him outside of Maroons, we were past reason. Human emotion is beyond comprehension, smooth and uninterrupted, like an orb made of blown glass.
Roy. Standing on the sidewalk outside the restaurant, I memorized her, the shape of her lips and the purple tint of her lipstick, which matched the streaks in her hair. I knew her accent, southern, but not too much, and I knew her shape, thick through the hips, but slim on top. I had said her name was something old-timey, but I should have said something classic. I could remember the feel of her name in my mouth, like the details of a dream.
"Want to see Brooklyn?"
she asked.
"My other roommate works at two steps down. If we go there, we can drink for free."
My first mind was to tell her that we didn't need free cocktails, but I had a feeling she would be more annoyed than impressed. So I said, "Let's get a taxi."
"You won't get a taxi tonight."
"How come?" By way of question, I tapped the brown skin peeking out between my camel hair coat and my soft leather gloves.
"That,"
she said.
"And it's snowing. Meters double. We better take the subway."
She pointed at a green orb, and we descended a staircase into a world that reminded me of that dark scene in The Wiz.
"After you?"
she said, depositing a token at the turnstile, nudging me through. I felt like a blind man who left his cane at home. "You know," I said, "I'm here on business. Sales meeting in the morning." She smiled in a polite way.
"That's nice,"
she said, but she didn't care at all about my professional standing. Hell, I didn't even care about it all that much, but the point was to remind her that I had something going on in my life. I'm not a fan of public transportation. In Atlanta, there was the bus or the MARTA train, and you only took those if you couldn't afford a car. When I first got to Morehouse, I had no choice, but as soon as I gathered four nickels at the same time, I bought myself the last remaining Ford Pinto. Andre called it the auto bomb, on account of the safety issue, but it never stopped him or anybody else from bumming a ride. The A-train was nothing like you would think from the song. The New York subway was packed with people, and you could smell whatever stuffed their damp sleeping bag coats. The floor was covered with the kind of linoleum that you only find in the projects, and the seats were a fixed income shade of orange. And do not get me started on the able-bodied men sprawled out, taking up two seats, sometimes while ladies were left standing. For the jerky ride, we stood in front of a black lady who clenched a large shopping bag to her chest and slept like she was at home in a bed. Beside her was a light-skinned dude, the type we used to call DeBarge. He had a portrait gallery inked all over his head. Over his cheekbone was a woman's face, and she appeared to be weeping. "Georgia," I said into her hair, "how can you live up here?" She turned around to answer me, and our faces were so close that she leaned back to keep from kissing me.
"I'm not really living here. I'm in grad school, paying dues."
"So you're pretending to be a waitress?" She adjusted her grip on the strap and lifted her foot to show me a black shoe with a thick rubber sole.
"Somebody needs to tell my feet I'm pretending because they are killing me like I'm really working."
I chuckled with her, but I felt sorry, thinking about my mama back in Louisiana, who was always complaining about her arches. She claimed it was because of the high heels she wore on Sundays, but it was really from being on her feet all day, fixing trays at the meet and three. "What are you in school for?" I hoped that she wasn't getting a PhD, an MBA, or a law degree. It's not like I had anything against women getting ahead in the world, but I didn't want to have to explain why it was that I decided to cool my heels with just my BA.
"Fine arts," she said, "concentrating on textiles and folk art."
I could see from the little turn up at the corner of her eyes that she was so proud that she could have been her own mother, but I had no idea what she was talking about. "Is that right?" I said.
"I'm an artisan," she said,
not like she was explaining, but like she was sharing the good news.
"I'm a doll maker."
"That's what you're going to do for a living?"
"Haven't you ever heard of Faith Ringgold?"
I hadn't, but she kept on.
"I want to be like her, with dolls instead of quilts. I want to get a tax ID and go into business."
"What's the name of the corporation?"
"Baby Dolls," she said.
"Sounds like a strip club."
"No, it doesn't,"
she said, loud enough that it woke up the lady dozing on the seat in front of us. The guy with the face tattoos twitched a little bit. "It's just that my degree is in marketing," I said. "It's my job to think about things like that." She kept looking like she was offended in a pretty meaningful way. "Maybe another name might be more effective." Since it seemed like I was moving in the right direction, I kept going. "You could call it poupées. That's French for dolls."
"French?"
she asked, eyeing me.
"You're Haitian?"
"Me?" I shook my head. "I'm a standard-issue American Negro."
"But you speak French?"
She sounded hopeful, like she had a translation job that needed doing. For a second, I considered throwing down my Louisiana credentials, because women dig it when you claim to be Creole, but I didn't feel like lying to her. "I studied French in high school and took a few hours toward a minor at Morehouse."
"My supervisor, Didier?"
she said.
"He's Haitian, kind of Haitian. He was born in Brooklyn, but still Haitian. You know how it is up here. He speaks French."
I may seem like I fell off a turnip truck, but I knew enough to know that it's never a good sign when a woman brings up another brother out of the blue like that. After we changed trains, she finally said,
"This is our stop,"
and led me up a filthy little staircase tiled like a public restroom. As we emerged into the Brooklyn night, I was surprised to see trees up and down the sides of the road. As I looked up at their stripped branches, chubby snowflakes floated down. I'm a southern boy by birth and constitution, so a real snowfall was something to see. It was all I could do not to stick my tongue out to taste one.
"It's like TV," I said. "Tomorrow it will be all filthy and stacked up on the side of the road, but it's nice when it's fresh like this."
We turned down the next street and I wanted to take her hand. The buildings on each side of the road were light brown, like pencil shavings, and the walls of one touched the other so that the road appeared to be flanked by castles. She explained that each of the brownstones was built to be houses for one family, all four stories, but now they were cut up into apartments.
"I live right there," she said,
pointing across the street and down.
"Garden level, see?"
I followed her arm with my eyes.
"Oh, hell no," she said. "Not again."
I was squinting in the light, trying to peek between the snowflakes to see what she was worried about. Before I could figure out what from what, she hollered,
"Hey!"
and took off like she had been snapped from a slingshot. She got 4 or 5 seconds on me, just from the surprise factor. When I took off after her, I still wasn't 100% sure what was going on. I gave it all I had, but I was still pulling up the rear. Like Spike Lee said that time, it's the shoes. What I wore on my feet were for styling, not striding. Oxblood floor shines that would make a preacher covetous. Leather upper and sole. Celestial had on glorified nurse's shoes, ugly as newborn puppies, but a plus in a street race. When I spotted the dude running, I assessed the situation. In between her calling him all kinds of motherfuckers, she ordered him, "Put my shit down!" Apparently, we were chasing a burglar, one who could really move. She was going pretty good, but this dude was booking. He had on a pair of Jordans he probably stole from somebody. And like I said, it's the shoes. Carlton Avenue is a long street, brownstones on each side, all the way, and trees with roots that buckled the sidewalk, turning the chase into an obstacle course. Apparently, I was the only one without prior experience. Celestia was hopping over the exposed roots without missing a beat. The burglar was even better, graceful, even. You could tell this wasn't his first rodeo. He knew she wasn't going to catch him. I knew she wasn't going to catch him. As a sensible man, I'm not one to chase wild geese, but I had to keep running as long as she did. How would it look if I hung back while my date chased a criminal? So I kept pushing, even though I was struggling to breathe. A man does what he has to do. How long did this chase go on? Forever. Between the cold air icing up my lungs and shoes pinching my feet, it occurred to me that I might be killing myself. Ahead, Celestial focused on a kid and cussing like a longshoreman. I caught a Charlie horse, only it was in my heart. Even though all the profanity slowed her down here, it wasn't looking good for me. I was bigger, late to start, and to cap it off, I was dressed like Louis Farrakhan. I'm no follower of the nation, but the thought of Farrakhan gave me a little boost. He may be outrageous on some matters, but he has a grip on some basic things. No matter what Minister Farrakhan happened to be wearing, there was no way he would let a sister apprehend a burglar while he sat back and watched. I swear, just then, the god smiled on me. As I dug down in my inner reserve for strength and endurance, Celestial's foot snagged on a chunk of jagged sidewalk, and she went sprawling. In three strides, I caught up and jumped over her like Carl Lewis. For me, the race was over right then, before my dress shoes hit the ground. They could have played the theme music and rolled the credits with me in midair. Too bad this wasn't a movie. I landed, slid a few inches in the wrong direction, got my bearings back, and kept moving. The kid was only a couple of sidewalk squares ahead, looking back. Now I went for the grand prize. I pumped my arms and legs harder, trying to recall anything I learned from high school track. Then he stumbled, costing him some ground. He was close enough now that I could read the label on the back of his shirt. Connie. My fingers closed around his skinny ankle as I hit the asphalt with my right knee taking the lead. He gave his leg a couple of vigorous shakes, but I was holding on for dear life.
"What the hell is wrong with you?"
he marveled.
"What if I had a gun?"
I honestly stopped a second to think about it, and in that second, he jerked his foot free and kicked me in the face. To his credit, I will say that he didn't kick me as harshly as he could have. He didn't stomp my head into the sidewalk. As kicks go, it was more like a love tap, delivered straight to my mouth, knocking loose one of my bottom teeth. Behind me, I could hear Celestial's rubber-soled footfalls. I was scared that she was going to play me like a hurdle and continue this crazy chase, but she stopped and knelt beside me. "I didn't get your stuff back," I said, gasping for breath.
"I don't care. You're my hero," she said.
I thought she was being funny, but her hands on the side of my face said that she wasn't. The dentist who fitted me for a bridge told me that he could have saved my tooth if I had gone to the hospital. Celestial even suggested it at the time, but I waved it away as we headed back to her small apartment that she shared with three people and a dozen baby dolls. She gave me a cold compress and called the police. The officer didn't arrive for another 2 hours, and by then my nose was wide open. I was giddy like the Jackson 5, Do-Re-Mi, A-B-C. On the police report, she signed her full name, and I would have tattooed it on my forehead. Celestial Gloriana Davenport.
Andre. The whole truth wasn't anybody's business but mine and Celestial's. On the Sunday before we laid Olive to rest, I visited the prison while Celestial stayed with Roy's father. I say visit for lack of a better term. Maybe it's best to say that I went to see him. As we shared three bags of chips from the vending machine, Roy asked me to take his place on Monday morning and carry his mother's casket from the hearse to the altar. I agree, but not gladly. This wasn't a task you take on with pleasure. Big Roy had drafted an extra deacon to carry the right-hand corner load, but I was to explain to him that Roy sent me and the deacon would step aside. We shook on it, like we were finishing a business deal. When we let go, I stood up to leave, but Roy didn't move.
I got to stay here until visiting hours are over.
You'll just sit?
He curled up one side of his mouth.
It's better than going back in there. I don't mind it.
I can wait another minute, I said, returning to the plastic chair.
You see that dude?
He pointed to a skinny man with a flat-top fade and Malcolm X glasses.
That's my father, my biological. I met him in here.
I stole a glance at the older man who was speaking to a chubby brunette wearing a flowered dress.
He met her from the classifieds,
Roy explained. I wasn't looking at his lady, I said. I'm tripping, your actual father.
Apparently so.
He went over my face slowly, like he was searching a grid.
You didn't know, he said. You didn't know.
How would I know?
Celestial didn't tell you. If she didn't tell you, she didn't tell anybody.
As he was pleased, I felt a little sting somewhere between a mosquito and a yellow jacket. You look like your pops, I said, pointing with my chin.
Big Roy is my pops. Him over there? We're cool now, but back in the day, nigga went for a pack of cigarettes and never came back. Now I see him every day.
He shook his head.
I feel like it's supposed to mean something, like in the whole scheme of things. But I don't know what.
I sat there, silent, uncomfortable in the gray suit I would wear to the wake later in the day. I had no idea what it could mean. Fathers were complicated beings. I was 7 when my father met a woman at a trade show and defected, creating a new family. My dad had pulled this sort of trick before, falling stupid in love with a stranger and threatening to set up house with her. His business, running an ice house, required that he travel to conventions, where he got caught up in the excitement. He was a passionate man, clearly. When I was 3, he fell for a woman who hailed from the world of dry ice and shipping. But she decided not to leave her husband, and he returned to Evie and me. After that, there were other zealous flirtations, but nothing stuck. He met the ice sculptress at an overnight trade show in Denver. After just under 36 hours in her marvelous company, he came home, packed up all his shit, and was gone for good. For whatever it's worth, they have a son and a daughter together, and he hung tight and watched them grow up. I spread my hands. The Lord works in mysterious ways?
Something like that,
he said.
My mama is gone.
I know, I said. I'm sorry. He shook his head and contemplated his palms.
I appreciate you,
he said,
carrying her for me.
You know I got you, I said.
Tell Celestial I miss her. Tell her I said thank you for singing.
No problem, I said again, pushing up from my chair.
Dre, he said, don't take this the wrong way, but she's my wife. Remember that.
And he smiled, big and broad, revealing a dark gap.
I'm just kidding, man. Tell her I asked after her.
Celestial isn't the kind of singer you would want at your wedding. While her mother is a gravity-defying soprano, she is a Scotch and Marlboro's alto. Even when she was a little girl, her voice was like the middle of the night. When she gives a song, it isn't entertaining. Rather, it sounds like she is telling secrets that are not hers to reveal. Just as Roy asked me to be a pallbearer, he asked Celestial to offer up a hymn. She walked to the front of the congregation, not looking at all like herself. With her hair ironed straight and a navy blue dress borrowed from Gloria, she seemed humbled. Not brought low, but there was respect in her decision not to be gorgeous. Miss Olive loved 2 things. The microphone gave her words a ghost echo. She loved the Lord, and she loved her family. Especially her son. Most of you know why Roy is not here, but he's not absent. As Celestial stepped back a few paces, the nurse ushers communicated with hand signals, ready to swoop in case she was about to break down. But she was stepping back only because her voice was too big for her to stand so close to the sound system.
She sang Jesus Promised Me a Home without the benefit of a piano accompaniment, looking past the casket of dark wood, staring right at Roy Sr. She gave it all she had until women stood up and raised their fans, and a gentleman in the front room repeated, "Thank you, Jesus." Singing, she wounded and healed both. If he said it, I know it's true. She wasn't grandstanding or trying to break him down, but she hollered out that melody, delivering both the Holy Spirit and earthly emotion until Big Roy's shoulders bucked and the cooling waters came down. I'm no theologian, but there was love in that room. She said that Roy was not absent, and when she finished, not one soul doubted this. Celestial returned to the pew beside me, exhausted, and I took her hand. With her head on my shoulder, she said, "I want to go home." After the eulogy, which was standard fare about wives and mothers, with talk of the Book of Ruth, it was time for the pallbearers to take our places. Roy Sr. insisted that we bear her weight in the formal way, balanced on our shoulders without the benefit of hands. The mortician directed us like he was conducting an orchestra, and at his command the six of us settled Miss Olive upon our shoulders and inched our way out of the sanctuary. There is no weight like the burden of a body. The load was shared by six, but I felt alone in my labors. With every step, the casket bumped my ear, and for a superstitious second, I thought I was maybe receiving a dispatch from the other side. The three of us, Roy Sr., Celestial, and me, rode in a limousine driven by the undertaker's son, who asked if we wanted air conditioning. "No, Reggie," Roy Sr. said. "I prefer fresh air." And he lowered the window, letting in a humid breeze as thick as blood. I sat still, concentrating on breathing. Celestial was wearing a perfume that smelled like romance. Roy Sr. sucked on peppermint, strong and sweet. On my left side, Celestial took my hand, and I enjoyed the cool feel of it.
"I would appreciate it if you wouldn't do that," Roy Sr. said.
She pulled her fingers away, leaving me with a vacant palm. After a few miles, the hearse led the small processional down a bumpy, unpaved road. The jostling unlocked something in Roy Sr., who said,
"I love Olive in ways you young people can't even picture. I was the best husband I knew how to be, and the best father I could manage. She showed me how to join with a woman. She taught me to take care of a little boy."
I flexed my hand. "Yes, sir," I said, and Celestial hummed a tune I recognized but didn't know the title of. She was like a different person, deeper and broader, like she perceived something about life and death and love that I had the luxury of not knowing yet. At the cemetery, we hefted the coffin again. As we made our way to the grave, I marveled at how a town so small had accumulated so many dead. Near the front were the modern headstones, polished granite, but in the distance stood time-worn markers, limestone probably. For this leg of Olive's journey, we were allowed to use our hands to steady her, and then we set her down on the straps stretched across the gaping hole in the earth. The minister was behind us, chanting as he took his place. He spoke about the corruptible body that worms would destroy and the immaculate, untouchable spirit. We all said, "Dust to dust." The small crowd of mourners pulled apart the floral arrangements, tossing the bright flowers into the hole as workers loosened the straps and lowered Olive into the ground. Under the green tent, Celestial sat next to Roy Sr., soothing him as the top of the cement vault was thumped into place. She dabbed at her eyes with wadded tissue while the workers unrolled the astroturf from the pile. They hung back, not wanting to start up the earth mover tractor while the family was still there. It troubled me a little to think that Celestial, Roy Sr., and I constituted the family, but there we were. I stood up. "I think it's time for us to go, sir. People will be waiting for us at the church." Celestial stood, too.
"Everyone will be there."
"Who is everybody? Ain't no everybody without my wife."
Behind us, the gravediggers were antsy and ready to do what they had been hired to do. I could smell the grave, fertile and musty, like fishing bait. Finally, Roy Sr. stood and went over like he was going to grab a handful of soil and toss it over the coffin, already settled 6 feet down. Celestial and I walked close behind and were surprised when he sat down on the mound in a deliberate way, almost like a protest. Celestial said,
"Sir?"
And Roy Sr. didn't say anything. Celestial followed him and sat, too. I swiveled my head looking for someone to help us out here, but the few mourners had gone, likely heading back for the repast supper. Taking her lead, I joined them. The dirt was wet, and the moisture seeped in through the seat of my trousers, as the gravediggers spoke to each other in hushed Spanish. Although I was close on his right flank, Roy Sr. spoke only to Celestial, explaining to her that she was the one responsible now.
Olive went to see little Roy every week, right up until she was too sick to make the journey. She stays on top of Mr. Banks. She calls him every Wednesday around lunchtime. I can't say what he has done so far, but she kept on him. She's gone now. So it's up to you, Celestial. I'll do what I can, he explained. But a man needs a woman to care after him.
Celestial nodded with wet eyes.
Yes, sir,
she said.
I understand.
Do you? He said, regarding her with wary eyes. You think you know everything, but you're too young, girl.
I stood up and brushed the back of my clothes. I held out a hand to Celestial and she pulled herself up. Then I extended my hand to Big Roy.
Sir, let's go and let these men do their work.
Roy Sr. got up, but he didn't use my arm for support. He is a big man, and beside him I felt narrow as a switch.
It ain't their work, he said. It's mine.
Then he strode over to a tree and picked up the shovel resting against the bark. Though not a young man, Roy Sr. moved the earth in heaping shovelfuls and heaved it onto Olive's vault. I'll never forget the sound of the landing dirt. I picked up the other shovel, thinking of Roy and that I should be his understudy here. Roy Sr. barked that I should put the shovel down, but then, kinder, he said,
"This isn't your job. I know you call yourself stepping in for little Roy, but even if he was here, this wouldn't be none of his work either. This is personal. Just me and my wife. I need to cover her with my own hands. You and Celestial take the Cadillac. I'll meet you when I'm done with what I need to do."
We obeyed him like he was our own father. We walked away, weaving through the headstones until we reached the sedan idling on the path. When we opened the door, we surprised the driver, who hastily shut off the dance music bumping through the speakers. As we pulled away, like children, we twisted to look through the back windshield, watching Roy Sr., John Henry, his wife's grave. Celestial sighed.
"You'll never see anything like that again, no matter how long you live."
"I don't want to."
"Roy has been away so long,"
she whispered.
"I've done everything I'm supposed to do. I haven't thought about any other man, let alone touch one. But when I look at Mr. Roy out there, at his wife's grave, I feel like I've been playing at marriage. That I don't know what it is to be committed."
And then she sobbed a wet spot onto my dirty white shirt.
"I don't want to go to the church. I just want to go home."
I shushed her and tilted my head in the direction of the driver and made my voice low. "This is a small town. No need broadcasting anything that could get misinterpreted." A quarter of an hour later, we walked into Christ the King Baptist Church, as filthy as coal miners, and ate a meal fit for royalty. People talked about us, I know they did, but to our faces they were polite and kept pouring more fruit punch. I looked Celestial in the eye and knew that, like me, what she wanted was a vodka martini, extra dry, but we made our way through the soul food dinner, and we didn't leave until it was clear that Roy Sr. wasn't going to show. It took us a while, but we found a bar where we could crash. It would have been quicker to drive 30 miles up the road to the casino, where the drinks were cheap and the bartenders heavy-handed. When I steered the car in that direction, Celestial stopped me.
"Don't go that way," she said. "I don't want to pass the prison.
That's cool, I said.
Is it?
Celestial said.
It's shameful that I can't even look at the barbed wire fence while he has to live behind it. Do I love him, Trey?
I couldn't answer her. You married him. She turned toward the window, tapping her forehead against the glass. I reached in my jacket pocket and gave her my handkerchief, driving one-handed, on the lookout for a bar we could belly up to. It's not like there was any shortage of booze in Elo. There were package stores and churches every 100 feet. Men stood on corners, tipping brown bags. If I didn't find something soon, we would buy a bottle and pass it back and forth like winos. Finally, we ended up at Earl Picard's Saturday Nighter, a joint that looked like it had been a 7-Eleven in its last incarnation. We chose 2 wobbly bar stools and watched hot dogs ride around a red light bulb. The windows were painted over, so although it was only 2 o'clock in the afternoon on the streets, it was perpetually 2 a.m. inside. Hardly anyone was there, but I guess the people with jobs were at work, and the unemployed weren't wasting their money on liquor by the glass. When we sat down, the bartender looked up from the book she was reading with the help of a pocket flashlight.
"What can I get you?"
she asked, setting down the flashlight and sending a circle of light to the ceiling. This was not exactly a martini sort of establishment, so a Celestial asked for a screwdriver, and the bartender poured a good 4 fingers of Smirnoff into a flimsy cup before opening a can of juice. She rummaged under the counter and produced a jar of cherries, spearing them with a plastic sword. We drank without tapping our cups together. We were so dirty that I tasted grit in my drink. "Do you think that Roy Sr. is still out there with his shovel? Or do you think he let the machines take over after we left?"
"He's out there," Celestial said. "He's not going to let a tractor bury her."
Shaking her drink to chill it, she asked,
"What about Roy? How's he holding up?"
"He was okay, I guess. He said to tell you that he misses you."
"You know that I love him, right, Dre? His mother never believed me."
"Well, she didn't know you, did she? Maybe she didn't think anybody was good enough for her son. You know how black mamas are."
"I want another round,"
she said, and the bartender mixed more vodka and orange juice. I rooted in my pocket, fishing out some quarters. "Slow your roll, cowboy," I told her. "Go put something on the jukebox." She took the money and walked to the back, unsteady, like she was walking on someone else's legs. Her hair responded to the humidity, losing that funeral lankness and drawing up around her ears. The men sitting at the other end of the bar noticed her figure as she bent at the waist to peer into the jukebox. "That's your wife?" the bartender asked me, with what might have been a flirtatious flicker in her eye. "No," I said. "We're old friends. We drove up from Atlanta for a funeral."
"Oh," she said. "Olive Hamilton?"
I nodded.
"So sad. Is she the daughter-in-law?"
I had a feeling she already knew. That little glint wasn't anything more than small-town nosiness. As Celestial made her way back to me, the bartender retreated like she was embarrassed. Suddenly Prince sang out of the jukebox, "I want to be your lover." I said to her, "Remember in the 8th grade, when we thought Prince was saying, 'I want to be the only one you cook for'?" Celestial said,
"I never thought that."
"You knew what cum was in the 8th grade.
"I guess I knew it was something."
We didn't talk for a while. She pounded cheap vodka, and I switched to beer, and then to Sprite.
"She hit me,"
Celestial said, rattling the ice in her cup.
"Roy's mother. When I stayed away too long. Next time she saw me, she slapped the tar out of me. We were having dinner at the casino, and she waited until Gloria got up to go to the bathroom, and she reached over, and pow!"
Celestial clapped her hands.
"Right across my face. Tears came to my eyes, and she said, 'Listen here, little girl, if I don't get to cry, nobody cries. I have suffered more just this morning than you have in your whole life.'"
"What?" I said, touching her cheek. "What the hell was that all about?"
"It was about everything. Olive slapped all the tears right out of me."
Then she covered my hand on her cheek with her own.
"All through the services, except when I was singing, my face was on fire. Right here."
She rubbed my hand over the soft place. Then she turned her head and kissed my palm. Celestial, I said, you are so drunk, baby girl.
I'm not,
she said, reaching again for my hand.
Well, I am, but I'm still me.
Stop it, I pulled my hand back. People in here have figured out who we are. I gave her a stern look with my head cocked to the side.
Oh, yeah,
she said.
Small town.
I nodded as her face fell a little. Microscopic. Now the Isley Brothers were on the jukebox. There was something about those vintage slow jams. Those old cats sing about a kind of devotion long since out of style. I always liked this song, I told her.
You know why?
Celestial said.
It's because this is the music we were conceived to. It speaks to you on a primal level.
I prefer not to imagine my conception. She was a little mopey now as she twirled the ice cube with her fingernail that was chewed down to the meat.
Dre, I'm so tired of this. Of all of this, this dirty little town. I'm tired of having in-laws and prison. Prison isn't supposed to be part of my life. I was married a year and a half. That's it. Roy got snatched up and my daddy was still writing checks to pay for my wedding.
I never got used to you as a Mrs. Hamilton. I signaled for the check and asked for two glasses of ice water. She rolled her eyes.
When you went to see him, did he seem mad at me? When I went last, he said he didn't like my vibe, that I was coming out of obligation.
She set her glass down.
He wasn't wrong, but what was I supposed to do? I work crazy hours at the shop, then I drive for hours to get to Louisiana and spend the night with his parents, who don't really even like me. Then I go through...
She fluttered her fingers.
Go through everything, and he doesn't think my smile is cheery enough? This isn't what I signed up for.
She was serious, but I laughed anyway. I didn't know there was a sign-up sheet. That's not how it works.
You can laugh,
she said with angry eyes.
You know how I feel when I'm here? Black and desperate. You don't know what it's like to be standing in the line to get in to see him.
I do, I said. I was there yesterday.
It's different for women. They treat you like you're coming to visit your pimp. Every single one of them smiles with a little smirk like you should know better, like you're a delusional victim. If you try to fix yourself up and look respectable, it's worse in a way. They treat you like you're an idiot because it's clear you could do better if you weren't such a fucking fool.
She popped her fingers to the music like she was trying to snap herself out of the spell of feelings coming over her. But she was buzzed enough that her emotions weren't hers to control. Had we been alone, I would have touched her. But under the eyes of the bartender and the three other men present, I didn't lift my hands. I just said, let's go. When we got back to the hotel, it was light out, but the casino parking lot was full. Apparently a 10-car giveaway was scheduled for this evening. When we were safe behind the doors of the elevator, I faced her. She fastened her arms around my torso, reminding me of our childhood when she used to hug the breath out of me. She smelled like vodka, but also like lavender and pine trees. I held her until we reached the fifth floor, even as the doors opened, revealing a family patiently waiting to get on board.
Newlyweds,
the mother explained. We stepped out of the elevator and stood facing the hall leading to our rooms.
Everyone thought we would get married one day,
she said. You're drunk, I said. Way drunk.
I disagree.
She made her way to her room and slid the key into the door. Tiny green lights twinkled.
I'm something, but I'm not drunk. Come in. Do you want to?
Celestial, I said, though I felt myself leaning in her direction like someone tipped the world. It's me, Dre. She laughed. And it sounded playful like we hadn't watched Roy's daddy bury his wife with an old-fashioned spade. She laughed like this was a time before anything bad had ever happened.
It's me, too,
she said with a grin.
Celestial.
I tried to laugh back, but no sound came. Besides, any laugh would be fake, and I never faked anything when it came to her. It was all over when I stepped over the threshold and heard the door click shut behind me. We didn't fall into each other's arms like in a movie, with furious deep kissing and groping. For the first slow moments, we just looked at each other, like what we had chosen was a package that we couldn't quite figure how to open. She sat on the bed, and I did too, and it reminded me of the other time when we crossed the line, in high school. Then, like now, we were dressed up and frazzled. Back then we had been in the dark basement, yet I could make out the outlines of the ruffles of her party dress. But now we were in the full light. Her hair swelled around her head in a dark halo. Both our mouths were hot with alcohol, and our clothes stained with graveyard soil. I moved closer to her and wound my fingers in her thick hair.
"We've always been together," she told me. "Not like this, but always."
I nodded. "I want to be the only one you cook for." We laughed, a real laugh, a shared laugh. This is when our life changed. We came to each other with joy on our lips. What came next may not have been legally binding. There was no clergyman or witness. But it was ours. Roy. In Elo, if you want to know who you're supposed to be, you don't have to go further than the family Bible. Right there, on a blank page, before "in the beginning," is all you need to know. There were other truths in the world, but they weren't often written down. These unofficial records of kin were passed from lips to ear. Much was made of white relatives, whispered about, sometimes in shame, sometimes in satisfaction, depending on the details. Then there was other family on the right side of the color line, but the wrong side of the property line. I was the rare soul in Elo with no family ties outside of my parents. Olive was born in Oklahoma City, and there was family there, but I never met them. Big Roy was from Howland, Texas, and wandered to Elo on his way to Jackson. Our family Bible they received as a wedding gift from Big Roy's landlady. When you lift the leather cover, there are only our three names spelled out in Olive's careful cursive. Roy McHenry Hamilton, plus Olive Ann Engelman. Roy Othaniel Hamilton, Jr. Olive never wrote Celestial's name beside mine, but there was a lot of room on the page. Space to list all the Hamiltons of the future connected with diagonal lines and dashes. Davina Hardrick was different. At least a dozen black Hardricks lived in town. Even a few Hardricks without the C, who changed their names when the family split like a feuding congregation. I envied her those robust roots, thick enough to buckle the sidewalk. She said she was living in Miss Annie Mae's house, and I tried to remember who Miss Annie Mae was to her, what Bible lines connected them. I remember Davina's grandfather, Mr. Picard, or maybe he was her uncle. There had been something extended about her family, that much I did remember. Once I had known who all was kin to anybody else. I had run into Davina at Walmart when I had gone to buy flowers for Olive. Davina, dressed in a blue uniform, unlocked the floral refrigerator and helped me select a bouquet that I couldn't bring myself to deliver. Wrapped in my purchase in clean white paper, she asked me if I remembered her from high school, even though she was a couple of years ahead of me. I told her that I did. She asked me if I would like to have a home-cooked meal. I told her I would. A few hours later, I stood in front of the clapboard house outfitted for Christmas with multicolored lights and metallic ribbon. I climbed up the three concrete steps and stood on the sloping porch. The little house must have been 70, maybe 80 years old, built probably by Miss Annie Mae's husband. This neighborhood was known as the Hardwood, where the colored mill workers lived. Back when there was a mill, back when colored was a word of respect. I rapped on the silver-wreathed door, almost wishing I wore a hat so I could take it off and hold it in my hands.
"Hey,"
she said through the screen door, looking inviting in a holiday apron that set off her skin tone, a lush brown with red underneath like a nice pair of loafers. She tilted her head to the side.
"You look nice."
"You too." Kitchen aromas spiced the air all the way out here, and I wanted more than anything in this world to cross her threshold.
"You're early,"
she said with a little smile, not like she was annoyed, but letting me know.
"Give me a minute to fix my hair."
Then she shut the door. I sat down on the front stairs and waited. 5 years away, and you get good at that sort of thing. I sat there, but I didn't turn my face on a diagonal to the orange brick funeral home where they had taken care of my mother. Instead, I sat with my eyes on my own fingers, so much like Walter's, knotty with yellowish calluses. I went in with banker's hands and came out looking like a mill worker.
But at least I was out. Something you learn in there? Keep your mind on what's important. Edward Street was mostly quiet. A cluster of little boys used bacon and string to catch crawfish in a ditch that ran along the sides of the road. In the distance, I could see the reflection of the neon lights in the liquor store window and feel the faint vibration of the subwoofers that shook the air. This was my hometown. I skinned my knees on these streets. I learned to be a man on these same corners. But I didn't feel like I was home. When Davina came to the door the second time, she wasn't wearing an apron. And I missed it, though the burgundy dress she changed into highlighted everything captivating about a woman's body. In high school, she had a perfect figure, small and thick at the same time, what we used to call a brick house. Big Roy warned me those girls that are fine at 15 get fat by 30, so you shouldn't marry them. Thinking of Davina, that advice seemed childish and cruel. Yes, she had a lot going on in the bust and the hip, but she looked delicious.
You still married?
She asked through the screen door. I don't know, I said. She smiled, cocking her head, showing a tuft of tinsel tucked behind her ear like a gardenia.
Come on in, she said. Dinner will be ready in a minute. You want something to drink?
What you think? I watched her splendid curves as she walked a few steps to the kitchen. The old me, and I don't mean the me before I went to prison. I mean the old me from way before I started going out with Celestial. The me I was in my early 20s and running through women like water. That me would have known what to say. Back then, I knew how to focus. Keep my mind on my money and my money on my mind. I used to say that to myself under my breath, no matter what it was that I was zooming in on. One thing at a time. That's how you win. But here I was, in front of one woman, one fine woman, and I was sitting here thinking about a wife I hadn't talked to in 2 years. I'm not saying that I was anybody's angel during my marriage. As they say, mistakes were made and feelings were bruised, like that one time when Celestial happened upon a receipt for 2 pieces of lingerie, not just for the one I gave her for her birthday. She wasn't livid, but it was going that way. I said to her, Celestial, I don't love anybody but you. It didn't necessarily explain the little piece of paper in her hand, but it was God's truth, and I suspect that she understood that. Sitting in Davina's living room drinking up her liquor, I held Celestial's face in my mind, her scent in my nose, her song in my ear. Even still, I looked at Davina and my mouth went wet. When did Miss Annie May pass? I asked her. She was a nice lady. I remember when she sold sour pickles for a dime when we were little. You remember that?
She's been gone 4 years now. I was surprised that she left everything to me, but we were always close, and her son lives in Houston now. His name was Wofford. Remember him?
I did remember him as the local boy made good who came to speak to us when we were in high school, telling us not to drop out, get anybody pregnant, or smoke crack.
Yeah, I recall.
Davina smirked.
With Miss Annie May gone, I don't expect we will ever see him again in this town.
She shook her head.
My daddy was the same way, halfway to Dallas before I even turned 5 years old.
I said, you don't know for sure why he went. She smiled again, a real smile like she appreciated me trying to look on the bright side.
All I know is that he's gone. Same trifling story everybody tells.
Don't call him trifling, I said. Men have reasons. She shushed me.
You didn't come here to talk about my daddy, did you?
And there was a question in her question. Women have that way of asking you more than what they want to know. Food smells good, I said, trying to lighten the mood. Louisiana women, I swear y'all come out of the womb gripping a skillet. I hoped that I would get to the table and see a bowl of crowder peas pulled from the vines that grew along the fence that separated Davina's property from the neighbor's. When I was coming up, Mr. Fontenot, the language teacher, had lived there. I ended up enrolled in French class by accident, the only black kid in the room. Me and Mr. Fontenot were close, both being onlys. He told me about the French club, how they met after school and practiced the language in preparation for a 10-day trip to Paris. I asked Mr. Fontenot if there were black people in Paris, and he said, both local and imported. He gave me a novel by James Baldwin, Go Tell It on the Mountain, that had nothing to do with France, but he assured me that the author was there as we spoke. I turned the book over and studied the sad but intelligent face. James Baldwin was plenty black. Learn the language, Mr. Fontenot said. and I will help sponsor your journey. But three things happened. I would have been the only black kid going on a trip, and nobody thought much of that idea. Something goes wrong over there, and it will be your word against theirs, Big Roy said. Another thing was the money. $750 would have been my share even with Mr. Fontenot sponsoring me. That's why no black kids were going. And the last thing was Mr. Fontenot himself. When he hipped me to go tell it on the mountain, he didn't say one word about Jimmy being a homosexual. Jimmy is how Mr. Fontenot always talked about him, like they went way back. According to Mr. Fontenot, Jimmy started saving his papers for posterity when he was only 11 years old because he knew he was going to be important and that he was going to need documentation of his trajectory. He had then given me a little black notebook. You should keep a journal for future generations, he said. When you get out of this town, people are going to want to know how you did it. It was this journal that ended all my plans, more than the money. Big Roy didn't like the look of the little book, and neither did my mother. Elo is a small town, claustrophobic and mean sometimes. Didn't take more than a couple of phone calls for my parents to find out that Mr. Fontenot was funny like that. And there was no way they were sending me to Paris under his sponsorship. What happened to Mr. Fontenot?
He passed away in the early 90s, Davina said.
From what?
You know what I'm talking about, she said. Come on, you need to eat.
I got up and headed to the oval-shaped table, like the one I grew up eating on. Six people could fit easy. I pulled back the chair and was about to sit down when she asked me if I would like to wash my hands. Shamefaced, I asked her where the bathroom was. Lathering up with soap that smelled like girls, I felt a little prickle of anger along the underside of my jaw, but I splashed water on my chin until it settled. Tilting my head under the faucet, I filled my mouth with the soft water and swallowed it down. It had been a long time since I could look into a real glass mirror, but what I saw, I could have done without. My forehead was creased like the fan Olive kept in her purse. But at least I was clean. I was shaved. As soon as I got my money right, I would see a dentist and get fitted for a new bridge. Using a fluffy brown towel dangling from a hook, I dried my face and returned to the table, which Davina piled with a righteous feast. It was like something out of the Bible. Pork chops, swimming in gravy, macaroni and cheese, brown on the top and shiny with butter. Mashed potatoes heaped in a striped blue bowl, and next to that a stack of the white rolls Olive used to make. When you tugged them, they came apart in buttery sections. There, snug in a shiny silver bowl, were a few of the crowded peas I had been craving.
You want to say the blessing?
She said, reaching out for my hand. I closed my eyes and bowed my head, but I didn't get past Dear Lord when my throat started twitching. It took me two breaths to give up on talking. I clamped my eyes shut and swallowed hard against whatever it was that was trying to rise up and get out of me.
Dear Lord, Davina picked up. Thank you for this food that will nourish our bodies. We thank you for this fellowship. In the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
She squeezed my hand at the amen, like the period at the end of the sentence. But I kept squeezing, even when she tried to pull away. I managed to say, bless the hands that prepared it, before I let her go. As Davina spooned mounds of everything onto my plate, I imagined myself, a man just out of the joint, about to do some serious damage to some pork chops. I felt a little bit like a punchline, more self-conscious than I had ever been in corporate America, right here in my own hometown. Davina set the food down in front of me, and at the last moment I remembered my manners and didn't touch my fork until she picked up hers.
Bon appetit,
she said with a little smile. I set it back and remembered Celestial, who said just that before she ate anything, even her morning cereal. I was working my way through a second helping of food and a third round of sweet lemonade when Davina said in a tone that was too breezy for a question she asked twice already,
You still married?
I slowly finished chewing, swallowed, and washed it all down with lemonade. How you want me to answer that? This is what I got. I was married when I went in, and she didn't divorce me.
You don't have to talk in circles like a lawyer.
She seemed hurt, like I came here and ate her dinner under false pretenses. I took a breath and gave her as much truth as I had on me. I haven't seen her in 2 years, not since my mama passed.
You talk to her on the phone?
Not lately, I said. What about you? You with somebody? She looked around the room.
You see anybody up in here?
We let the subject drop, like we were both satisfied that we had done our due diligence.